You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Cecilia Fajardo Hill. Cecilia, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So Cecilia, there's a few things I want to talk to you about that you're working on, but perhaps first just for the audience to define where you are working and your responsibilities as a curator.
Yeah, so I am an art historian and a curator of contemporary art, modern and contemporary art, and my biggest project I've been working for 7 years now is Radical Women, Latin American Art, 1960-1985, which is an exhibition of 120 artists from Latin America, Latinas and Chicanas, that we consider to be radical artists during this period of 60-85 that have been somehow invisible in the system as a kind of a broad discourse of how we understand that contemporary art came to be what it is.
Now, and you're talking about the years, just to be clear, 1960 to 1980, is that correct?
85.
1985,
okay. Yes, which we consider like the second period of the pioneers. You know, you have the ones which started at the end of the 19th century to, you know, up to the 60s. But the 60s to 85 for us is like a time where a lot of the languages of contemporary art, as we understand today, were formed, you know, conceptual art, video art, a lot of performance art, new ways of thinking, photography and sculpture and so forth. So the artists in this exhibition are experimental artists of the web, not only rethinking the ideas of the medium. I mean, though, you know, the biggest medium in the exhibition is the video and photography, because they're the ones that have the least strong history of canonical art, therefore there is more freedom of expression in there, and all the kind of conceptual ideas that, you know, were developed through these kind of experimental forms. And you know, we consider that the kind of the great focus of the exhibition in terms of the radicality is an idea of a political body that is kind of at the center of all these experimental ideas. So the body is the metabolizer, as it were, of the discourse that is present in these women.
So let's talk a little bit about that so I understand that more. And perhaps we can pick one artist. I know just before we were interviewing off the record, we were talking a little bit about Annie Albers. Is she also in that exhibit?
No, the thing is, no, I'm thinking of her for a different project that I'm doing on Guatemalan art. That is a research project. No, because this exhibition is solely of Latin American, Latina, and Chicana artists. And basically, when you look at the history of the period, I mean, you have already quite a few exhibitions that happen, I don't know, possibly the most important one 10 years ago were Global Feminism or WAC. And always, well, or mostly when you have groups of women big exhibitions that, you know, trying to make a statement, the big umbrella is feminism, which is not happening with our exhibition, because what happens in Latin America for political and social reasons, artistic feminism wasn't a big thing. There was actually a rebellion against the idea of feminism, though the work could be seen as feminist. But it's a different type of work. But, I mean, in the exhibition, you may have...
Yeah, let's pick, I'm sorry to interrupt, but let's pick what I was getting at is let's pick one person maybe in the exhibition so we can use her or a few people to define and illustrate what you're talking about in terms of radicality and the the body politic how that also relates to the political situation.
Yeah, sure. So, for example, I mean, I can think of an artist called Maria Velia Marmolejo, who's been based in New York. She had to exile from Colombia because of the political system. As you know, there was a civil war going on in the country for a long time. And she started doing performance on the border between the end of the 70s and the early 80s. And she did, let's say, for example, performances which was related to the idea of violence from the government, where she would talk about the disappeared, and she will get completely dressed in white and then create some wounds in her feet and then walk on a white area. It really to make visible the fact that there was all this violence going on. And the fact is that when you present a public with this act of violence or self-violence, people are very impressed by it and they can't even look at it. Though, you know, in the meantime, the country has been slaughtered and people are basically ignoring it. Then, for example, she did a performance. There are different subject matter that she's in, she cares for, like ecological subject, political subject. One of them is women, and she did a ritual to the menstruation, which basically she kind of walked in a space and did this kind of dance where she will kind of impregnate with blood the wall and the areas where she was walking through. So these things, even today, you know, for example, the bodily fluids are pretty much taboo. I mean, people still have issues with that, and there are cases in the history of art where women have used menstruation as a, I mean, there is a work by Kubota where she got the vaginal painting. But, you know, this is just an example. Is a woman from Cali, you know, a city in the coast of Colombia. But then you have, I don't know, a Chicana woman in Los Angeles taking photographs and trying to talk about compulsory sterilization, you know, not compulsory, sterilization of women that was non-authorized was a way of the government to control, you know, the growth of Latino population in the States. And, you know, when I think of the political situation now, this kind of desire of the power structures not to want to control bodies again, and this desire to control the idea of a Latino population, you know, I can see that a lot of the problems that these women were dealing with, we can actually relate to them now. There were a lot of women in the exhibition that had to produce their work in during dictatorships in Chile, Brazil, Argentina, and some of his work is very powerful. This idea of political oppression, not being able to speak, and finding ways of doing it that is not kind of literary or literal, or that is not done in a way that, you know, is a victimized type of language that is somehow poetic. For example, another subject in the exhibition is eroticism, you know, the fact of kind of the somehow redefinition from the self of some sort of idea of desire and sensuality and beauty, as opposed to being defined by the male desire and patriarchal structures. So there is a lot of different subjects that are fine. And if we look or think of contemporary art, today, let's say in the States or in Europe, and we look at these women working parallel in, you know, these times, I mean, that they're completely invisible. We haven't seen them, but they have existed. They're there. And, you know, I am an art historian. For me, an exhibition like this is about creating a chapter of art history and allowing some of these artists to actually enter a conversation, a broader conversation about at history, art, culture, politics, and so forth, that is, you know, that we can't ignore anymore, you know. And especially in a moment in time like this where you know, I think there is a conflicting attitude towards neighbors and immigrants and Latinos and Latin America and so forth.
Right, we're at a time, and it's very interesting, yeah, that you say that. That at this moment in history, we're faced with a kind of unusual reversal, right? I mean, not only for women in general. I mean, the women's march was incredible, but also what looks like a, you know, pending reversal or challenge to Roe v. Wade and so many things, but also with how immigration is seen and borders all around the world. It seems
an
exhibit
very
that would generate a lot of conversation.
And the idea in really, I mean, in a way, you know, this initiative of Pacific Standard Time, LALA, that the Getty spearheading, from which our exhibition is part, you know, there will be 60 to 70 exhibitions in Southern California between Santa Barbara and San Diego. Ours is one of the projects. is basically to sparkle this conversation about the relationship between a place like Los Angeles and Latin America at large, and the Latino heritage and creativity that we tend to continue to want to ignore. And I think to present these histories that have been somehow suppressed are important. For example, in our exhibition, we actually create a dialogue between Latinas, Chicanas, and Latin American artists. And even in academic environments, the tendency is that we keep all these fields separate when there is really no reason. A Latina artist is an artist that is neither Latin American nor American, as far as I'm concerned. So the fall into this kind of void. And I think this idea of having an exhibition where you may have an artist that was in an oppressive regime in Chile and another one that was in an oppressive situation in Los Angeles in the 1970s, it creates incredible parallels, you know, because we tend to believe that, you know, these things happen far away. But the reality is a lot of, you know, we know this, especially through the, you know, the black history that, you know, the state has been less than kosher about all these things, and now is out in the open. In November, I had a dinner at my house where I invited Chicanos and Latina artists in the show, and it was just before the election, and they were all saying, I mean, we all fought in feminist marches, we all fought for, you know, the Chicano movement and social movements and so forth, and we knew that there was racism in the States, but we didn't know that it was so widespread. For them, it was like a shock. You're in your 70s, you fought all these things, and then suddenly they're all coming back to haunt you, giant. So I'm very happy that this exhibition is happening now, because it's a reminder that, you know, this type of conceptualizations and forms of art that speak about, you know, having a place in the world, speaking from yourself, redefining your body, and talking about issues like political oppressions are really important references, and also the references, because they are really powerful works of art. So they're not. So I feel, and you know, it has been very difficult to do it. We've worked for 7 years. I mean, it was going to happen in an institution that in the end didn't want to do it. So they immigrated eventually to the Hammer Museum, but it had an enormous amount of hostility. People considered that, you know, to have an exhibition about women today, it didn't make any sense. It stresses the actual problems that we want to discuss, and it's actually not true. The fact that in our day, you know, we have a gender discussion that goes well beyond the idea of, let's say, of the definition of a woman, it doesn't mean that that doesn't continue to be something that we need to discuss. And you can't bypass it, because the conversation has not ended. In some places, it hasn't even started. So for me, it is relevant.
It sure is. So this is happening at the Hammer, and what are the dates of that show? This is so people can come see it. There'll be links to what it's
doing. Yeah, the exhibition begins on the 15th of September and ends on the 31st of December. And it will actually tour to the Brooklyn Museum, and it will open at the Brooklyn Museum in April of next year. So whoever can make it to the West Coast, maybe can make it to the East Coast.
Oh, very good. Yeah, that's a great show to have at the Brooklyn Museum, which is, you know, of course, now under the directorship of Ann Pasternak, which sounds more like something that she would be receptive to. She's done a lot of shows recently that are more political.
Yeah, sure. And they have the feminist wing, and Catherine Morris is the director of the feminist section of the Brooklyn Museum. And it is not actually, I think, by chance that the director of the Hammer Museum is Anne Philbin, who is herself a feminist, and the chief curator at the Hammer Museum, though she came after we had already started working in the museum in the show, Connie Butler, who was a curator at WAC. At the end of the day, I still believe very much in this idea that there is this community of women, you know, that the idea of a solidarity, you know, the Lucy Lippert defines, you know, the broad definition of feminism is actually helping another woman, recognizing another woman. You don't need to be a woman or a man or whoever to do that. So I guess that's it.
Yeah. Well, that's exciting. I'm so glad you're putting that on, and really glad that it's coming also to Brooklyn and touring. So let's talk about. I know you're doing even more, and so would you like to talk about another project that you're doing at the moment?
Yeah. So basically, because I am, you know, a curator of contemporary art, but I'm also an art historian. So for me, a lot of the things I do have to do, well, not only with researching areas which I think that are somehow either invisible or suppressed for specific reason. And, you know, even though I started my postgrad studies, I did them in Europe, I decided to dedicate myself pretty much to work a lot with Latin American art. And since I've been in LA, I've been working also with Latina and Chicana art. But about 4 years ago, I was invited to curate a biennial in Guatemala. And then for me, it was an incredible experience because, you know, Guatemala is a very small country in Central America, and it's particularly invisible in terms of the art scene that there is there. And Guatemala is possibly, I don't know now, the top of my head, the artist that has the largest amount of living indigenous. I mean, the majority of the population is actually indigenous. So I have been, my PhD was on actually ideas of post-colonialism, and I focus a lot of my research on Jimmy Durham, who has now the retrospective where he started at the Hammer, now is at the Walker Art Center, who is a Cherokee artist. And I didn't really know anymore where to take this conversation about this idea of the art of the post-colonial, the decolonial. And in Guatemala, for me, it kind of opened a new window about it. So I started to work with a colleague called Jose Falconi, who is at Harvard University, and there's support from Harvard and a foundation from Guatemala to do a large book that covers the whole of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century in terms of how the languages of modernity and contemporary art were born. And it's an incredibly fascinating project because possibly the most relevant thing about it for me is that a lot of the modern discourses and even of contemporary art are somehow intertwined with cultural forms, which are not the typical Western cultural forms. They really come from the kind of the pre-Columbian and the live traditions of cultures from, you know, Mayan people in the country. And actually difficult to talk about it because, you know, whenever we fall into this thing about talking something indigenous or Mayan, we have immediately these kind of very set ideas in our head. But it's, you know, they're really, really extraordinary forms of contemporary art and inventiveness in terms of thinking of what may be relevant for a country like Guatemala or anywhere else in terms of creating art that may be political and contextual. And I think a lot in terms of, you know, an artist like Jimmy Durham that was always so powerfully political. And this is very much the same, you know, it's about inscribing a present where you have these references of what art may be and all the cultural references that have never been permeated as acceptable into the canon of art and somehow combining this and recreating this kind of new languages or forms of saying things. So for me, it's a fascinating thing, and I'm writing now a chapter on what are the things that marked the beginning of an avant-garde and contemporary art in Guatemala, and it's transverse with something very political and at the same time with these ideas of the indigenous, and also with really powerful discussions about abstraction, which are very much intertwined with pre-Columbian art. And for me, is incredibly rich, and I love the idea that, you know, we're doing something that is necessary, you know, because there aren't other histories out there at the moment.
Absolutely, and so that's what you're involved in at the moment. That research is ongoing.
Yeah, so this I've been working now for about 4 years, and then I've been working now for a little bit longer than that on a project which is a platform, it's called Abstraction in Action, and the platform is called anabstractionaction.com, is undergoing a little pause because the collection that used to finance the project that I was actually a curator of is no longer the sponsor of the project. But it's about trying to understand what happened with the languages of modernism and abstraction in Latin America, because it's become modern abstract art, geometric art in Latin America has become a complete canon and is a market thing too. So what is it? And, you know, there is sometimes a prejudice towards abstraction because people consider that it's not political enough, it's something very market-driven. So I was very curious to find that. It started like a research. This was like in 2000 and possibly 11. What I realized is that there is this huge, enormous field of people who are working with these languages of abstraction that cannot be seen as an antithesis to reality. It's basically kind of an extension or some sort of form of engaging with reality without the usual languages that we recognize, and they're being so ideologically completely loaded. So there is something to be said about something that is not completely obvious, therefore not completely readable, that may be also meaningful, political, conceptual, and so forth. And I also feel, because in Latin America, the division between the idea of the high and the low, high culture, popular culture, is not as has never been really as defined as it is here in the States, for example, in Europe. That that kind of creates kind of hybrid forms that are not as categorically exclusive between themselves. So as a field of research has been truly fascinating too. And this digital platform, I would like to do so many things with it, because, you know, I feel that, you know, we can do videos. I would like to invent ways of creating forms of actually thinking of abstraction in terms of a context on the screen. You know, you have foreground and you have the ground and so forth, to creating this kind of, which are things that I guess you could only do digitally. Mm-hmm. So I feel there is a lot to be done that could be developed in conjunction with artists.
So when you talk about that could be developed, I mean, just to move into that a little bit and the digital realm, how do you see that developing?
Well,
I mean, you're talking in terms of display and research and text,
yeah,
right, as well as images?
So basically my idea was, like, one of the reasons why abstraction is so, it's seen in such a traditional way is because normally we see it through means and always exhibited in a wall, on walls and in kind of more conventional ways. What about if we created a way within the screen to actually discuss certain issues? In effect, I have started a conversation between several artists that deal with ideas of sexuality and the body through abstraction. So what I was trying to ask them is, what images would you imagine somehow to create in relationship, creating these kind of dynamic collages and kind of forms of, you know, there's a whole realm also that has to do with the actual biology of seeing, how your eye relates to the idea of the focal view versus the peripheral view, how the distance between the peripheral view, which is the unconscious gaze that allows you to see depth and creates density in your gaze, is called eccentricity, the distance between, you know, that peripheral view and the focal view, which is what you're actually able to see in a direct way, and somehow engage a little bit more this interaction between this focal and this kind of unconscious gaze to suggest ways of seeing. And so I think there's a lot of things that could be done. I don't want...
Just to be clear about that would be kind of online and in people submitting things and going back and forth, or a book?
We will create this. So let's say I work on a project which is about, let's say, the body of sexuality and abstraction, and each artist decides to work with particular images, and the idea is to develop a software. I've already started to do some research on this, so that they can actually create. It's almost like creating a work within a work. so that they can invent ways of actually looking at their own work in some sort of contextual and dynamic way in the screen, so that it doesn't just look against like a white wall, the white cube. So that then if you are a spectator and go onto the website, you can actually experience the work in a particular way that you wouldn't otherwise. So what you normally, let's say, write in a text, let's say that a work relates to, I don't know, clothing, let's say. So instead of talking, yeah, this artist, you know, developed this range of colors, thinking of childhood clothing or whatever, so that you can actually somehow evoke these things with actual images or extract of images, close-ups and whatever. It's something that I'm working on at the moment. I have to see how I can develop it, but I'm fascinated with the idea because I feel that we need to somehow also use technology to renew certain ways of looking at certain genres of art, like abstraction. So that, but it has to be done with artists themselves so that they can somehow contribute to the way that this gaze can be made more complex and people can't just simply say, oh, this work is about lines and shapes or whatever, is about materiality. There's, for example, an artist called Adam Vallecillo, and he, we bought this piece at some point, I'm no longer in the collection, which is a really large wall, and it looks like this beautiful wall of made of stone, and it basically is made out of worn-out tiles that have been patched up. He's from, I'm just hesitating if it's Honduras, sorry. He's from Honduras, and really, I mean, there aren't that many resources of people patch up these tiles until really they can't exist anymore. So these tiles, which have been stretched into these squares, have a whole history of the geography and the social situation in which these tiles have existed, and they're there. They're these kind of silent, loaded materials already worn out. There's a whole history on them. So if you could actually create something that would allow you to actually bring to life a little bit the context of production so that it's not just that, you know, there is artists that deal with the actual history of modernism and abstraction in Latin America. You know, why not bring about the history of architecture or some modernist ideas about architecture, let's say in Brazil or Argentina and so forth. So I feel that it would allow to do something else, but I think it has to be done with the artist so that it doesn't become something didactic, which it doesn't make any point. It doesn't make any sense because it's, I don't think art is something that can be reduced to didactics or education or whatever. That's never been the point. The point is communicating things in complex ways.
It's so fascinating. That could grow in a lot of directions, but it's
the idea is experimenting and playing around with ideas so that abstraction is not simply seen as something that is devoid of anything to say or any context of production that may be interesting to see it beyond what may be. You know, and also, in a way, a lot of art that is actually uses, let's say, photography or recognizable forms from the world, it's very easy to make the point that we do understand what it is about simply because we recognize those forms. And it's absolutely not the case. You know, most of the time, anything that is a little bit thoughtful requires a lot of thinking, even when you're looking at Renaissance art, unless you understand what Botticelli, the canonical ideas of the time, the mythological ideas of the time, and so forth, then you won't be able to get as much as you could.
And this, so and the this challenge system is, would provide a tremendous amount of information and context, really, from the artist as well as the historian and curator, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah, I really would like to do it that way because, you know, I wanted to curate an exhibition which in the end was cancelled because the collection closed, but the idea was, it was ideas about contemporary abstraction in the everyday. So we were trying to create this kind of different context in space to understand. We were working with students at the University in Irvine that you know, that these objects are actually born out of the world, and they may suggest ideas of the daily life, daily, you know, existence. And there's nothing more intimate and more kind of approachable in a way that something that has to do with, you know, our day to day. But we don't think of it in abstraction. Abstraction, our history of, you know, our relationship to abstraction is a modernist idea, is a separate entity, is antithesis to everything that, you know, may be real or may be communicative. And it's no longer the case. I think it has a language that has evolved. Of course, there is still modernist abstraction, but it's not the one I'm interested in myself.
That's fascinating. I'm so glad we talked about that in particular. Before we go, I want to ask you what I ask everyone. What are you reading at the moment?
Well, I'm reading so many different things. I'm constantly reading. I mean, actually, if I were to tell you what I was reading today, I was reading the most eccentric book in the world. I mean, I don't know if you know it's an eccentric book, but for me it is. It's a book that was published possibly in the 1960s. I don't know. It's by a Mayanist called José Díaz Bolio. It's called The Geometry of the Maya and the Rattlesnake Art, because I am at the moment writing a chapter for this book on Guatemalan art, trying to understand the dynamic of the creation of an avant-garde. There is a very big debate in the newspaper about how is a group in Guatemala called Grupo Vertebra that emerged in 1969, and a really wonderful artist who is actually in radical women but not with abstract work, called Margarita Surya. And they kind of have a big debate in the newspaper about the validity of abstract art and what is contextual, what is political, what is a meaningful art for Guatemala versus the kind of big international expressions in Paris and New York and all this. So there is constantly this dynamic in Latin America of us versus them, and, you know, what is international versus what is local, and what is political and not. And this man has this idea that, you know, this geometry that pervades not only architecture, textile, and much of the whole of the art produced in the pre-Hispanic times permeates into the contemporary times, and it's a way for me to enter this idea that the abstraction that this woman Margarita Surya was doing was not simply looking at modernist abstraction in Europe, was actually looking at the colors of huipiles and this philosophical and more symbolic approaches to abstraction that were coming actually from the textile and the architecture of pre-Columbian Guatemala, the Mayan Guatemala. So this little book is a reference that she makes in one of these debates in the newspaper. So I found it secondhand in Amazon. And one of the reason why I mentioned Annie Albers earlier on is because I'm actually, Annie Albers wrote some interesting things about the Mesoamerican influence in her art and Joseph Albers and other artists, which is the other side of the story that normally is not as well known, because, you know, people have emphasized a lot the kind of avant-garde in relation to African primitive art, and the actual pre-Columbian part was a little bit discussed in relation to Henry Moore, but not much. But she actually makes an incredible case, and her work is absolutely exquisite. And in this chapter, I'm trying to somehow extrapolate into this modern language that relates back to pre-Columbian art, not only in Guatemala, but in Peru, other countries in Latin America, and artists like Annie Albers and Joseph Albers and others who are very interesting. So it's like, at the end of the day, things that seem completely disconnected, when we look, there is so much connection that we don't see, simply because art history is segmented, is segregated to create this kind of hierarchical compartment of important art history, genealogical art history, where, you know, who did it first is the most important one, and so forth. And, you know, I am against that genealogy and this idea who arrived first and the biggest conqueror. And, you know, I admire exhibitions like Inventing Abstraction at MoMA a couple of years ago, but, you know, I don't really believe that abstraction was invented in the early 20th century art in Europe and the States. For me, that's not true. So there are other genealogies, there are other histories that actually are associated to other cultures and other ways of seeing that have not been part of these great narratives of the great discourses of art. And I'm interested in those darker stories.
I'm so glad you mentioned that as well. Cecilia, it's been wonderful talking to you today. I want to thank you so much for your
time. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.